Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm here with Kirk. Howdy, Kirk.
Howdy. Good evening.
Howdy. All right. Kirk is in the fire zone, so if he's all choked up, he is surrounded by the worst fire in California history. So yeah. It looks goody there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bad. Even those that are not in the direct line of it as we are, the smoke just covers. It's been pretty bad this week. Yes, sir.
Hundreds of thousands of acres. All right, what I wanted to do this evening is begin where we left off a week ago. And I want to do that primarily because these statements in Bereshit, Genesis 26:5, is, on a 1 to 10 scale of importance, it's a 400. Very few things could be more overall, give any more credibility to the message that we've been given today. That Yahweh is known only through knowledge and understanding. That he is approached only through knowledge and understanding. That the covenant participation is based upon knowledge and understanding. And that faith is irrelevant. That Paul was absolutely wrong, and therefore you can throw away the Christian New Testament. This is an absolute affirmation that the approach that we have been taking is valid. So I think it's not only important to help underscore the value of what we have come to know and to give credibility to what we've come to know and what we have shared, but also for someone who may be listening for the first time, to affirm that God can only be approached through knowledge and understanding. There is no other path to him. So this is begins. This is become. Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just going to say, and I would add, where can you find that knowledge and understanding? It's only in the Testament. It's not the Quran. It's not the pathway of Buddha. Is it? It's the thing that everybody tries to ignore so badly.
Yeah. Last word in this list of things is Torah. So that is absolutely true. That's the only place you can find this information. It begins, this is because. Hekeb. It's for this reason. And remember, this is now the conclusion of the ultimate test, a validation as to whether or not you've come to know and understand and have acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant. So, it leads into this with Ekeb, which is this is because. This is the reason. This is the end result. This is the cause and consequence.
Yes.
This is the merit and the reward for trusting the visible trail of evidence. It's an interesting word because Akeb is from Akab, which is used frequently. Akab is the root of, guess whose name?
Yaakov.
Yaakov, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And it's
yeah, it's just fascinating how you're talking about the covenant, and the covenant was opened up to an entire community of people through Yaakov. And the word that is used here is written identically to and is based upon a cob. And I've always thought that Yaakov, while it doesn't have the hay in it, was probably originally written Yaakov. There's no reason to
think
otherwise than Yaakov. And then to dig in one's heels, leaving footprints which are straightforward and steadfast, unwavering with regard to Yah.
Planted it upright, and, yes.
Yeah, and that's a really an important thing. I think I shared it in programs a long time ago. I like to walk on the beach. And when I walk on the beach, I will practice a calm, which is just to feel what happens if you supplant your heels. And when you do that, you really are walking upright. You're walking steadfast. You're walking straight ahead. You're walking with purpose. And also, if you ever played tug-of-war as a kid or at a camp,
oh, yeah.
You know, what you do to prevail, to keep from being pulled aside, to keep from losing, is you dig in your heels.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what Yaakov did. He was forthright, straightforward, steadfast, unwavering, and strong because he dug in his heels. So here is the first word of this based upon the name of the individual who became Yisrael. So this is because to show the way to the benefits of the Rishitim. This is as important a use of Asher as any we have found. And Asher is that relational term that not only makes an association between things, not only makes a connection between things, but Asher also means to reveal the path, to show the upright and elevated state, to lead to a joyful attitude, to encourage someone by having the proper mindset, to make the connections which lead to building an enduring, close, and beneficial association. This is as important a use of Asher as you're ever going to find. This is because to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, Abraham. Now, the verb here is shama. If you read any English Bible, they will say that shama means obey. You've looked up shama, Kirk. Can you find any hint of obey in the word?
No, sir. It's all here. Listen to me.
Pay attention. There's only two ways you can translate shama and be accurate. Hear or listen. I don't think there's any difference between hear and listen, but
no.
Those are the only two English words that can be accurately used to translate shama. So it means to use your perception of hearing to completely process audible information so as to understand. And in case that was a question to people, the next word is ba-kol-i, my voice. Listen to my voice. Well, who's speaking here?
Yahweh is speaking here.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, how would you and I go about listening to Yahweh's voice?
Once again, to the Torah, where it's written down.
Just recite it.
Yeah.
Right. It's about kara. You know, kara means to read and recite, to invite and to welcome, to be called out and to meet. Well,
yes.
If you recite something, then you're speaking it aloud and you can hear it. Now, I think a lot of folks get maybe miss the importance of listening to Yahweh's voice and why it's important to recite. And I don't know if you do this because you're a visual person. I'm more of an audible person, Kirk. Well, I like to think of both visual and audible, and Jay maybe as well. I find that if I read something aloud, if I say it aloud, that I come to process it such that it resonates within me, It I understand it better, but mostly I retain it better.
Yes.
And I'm empowered when I recite it aloud to listen to the sound of the words and then be familiar with how they come across such that when the opportunity arises to share, I'm prepared, I'm rehearsed, and I'm prepared to share. But it is to speak words, you have to engage more of yourself. You have to use your eyes to read them, your brain to process what's there and what the sounds convey, and then you have to convey the sounds of each phonetic letter. And then you're using your sense of hearing to process what you're now saying, and then trying to ascribe meaning to it. It's a complete engagement. So much more than just reading. Now, I remember attending some board meetings back in my business days. I remember one of the gentlemen that attended the board meeting says, you know, you don't need to convey this orally. I can read seven times faster than you can speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can. And so can I. But you can't process it as well.
Yeah.
When you speak it, it can become part of you if you're processing it correctly. And to recite it, you are both observing it and listening to it. It's a much more compelling and comprehensive experience. But that's all you need to do. If you want to listen to Yahweh's voice, you do it what we're doing right now. Bar Rashid 26:5 is in Yahweh's voice.
Yes.
All you have to do is recite it, and you're listening to it. So this is because, to show the way to the relationship, Abraham Shama, listen to my voice. Now what's interesting here is that this listen to was written in the call perfect. And the reason that has some value for us is that the call means no nuances here. This is just literal. He literally listened to what I had to say.
Right.
And the perfect means that he did so completely, but this isn't something that we have to do on an ongoing basis. You listen to what he says and respond to it. That's what Abraham did. It doesn't mean you have to listen 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times or an infinite number of times. Just listen, and you've done what you need to do. But the next verb is shamar. The nice thing about shamar is it was written in a very different way. It was written in the imperfect, which means observation is something we need to make a habit of. We need to do on an ongoing basis. And it's to have these two verbs side by side, it's important for us to recognize that they each offer a little different, distinct aspect of how we come to know and understand, and therefore how we can come and respond appropriately. And the realization is that we ought to be observant forever. It just needs to be part of the fabric of our lives. We don't have to be reciting what Yahweh says all the time, but we should always be observant. And being observant doesn't mean, as the English translations would say, to keep.
No.
No, it just means to pay attention to what's around you. Keep your eyes open. There's all sorts of information and affirmations out there. Pay attention. Process it. Think about it. Respond to it. So, he listened to Yahweh's voice, and then he visually observed and carefully considered, and now he's going to have this list of things. So all of the things that follow would have had to have been read. So those who would say, well, you know, Abraham had this advantage, God spoke directly to him, not directly with him. That wasn't an advantage. We have a better advantage.
Yeah.
We can go over every nuance of this over and over again. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But what by using Shamar, he's saying that our position and Abraham's is such that we are in a hugely beneficial spot by comparison to Abraham. Abraham would have had handwritten text of these things.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been written on either parchment or on papyrus. In this day, it probably would have been written on parchment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you he would not have had the kind of illumination we have today in our homes. And he would not have reference materials to check every nuance of every word.
Right.
Our ability to observe these next list of things is vastly superior to his was, to what he had some 3,000 years ago. So we're privileged, if you will, over where he was. So what's the first thing we need to observe is my requirements and my responsibility. Mishmeret. Those are very different things. Requirements and responsibility. And so it's, you have to determine if Yahweh is saying he paid attention to, came to closely examine and carefully consider Yahweh's requirements. That'd be the requirements for participating in the covenant. That's what this test is all about. But also, and I think equally important, Yahweh's responsibility. And the word can mean both things. God has the responsibility of doing what he promised. He told Abraham that he was going to provide the lamb. That's where we spent all that time, Tehillah 53, is explaining how he provided the Passover lamb. He says, I'm going to provide the lamb. Don't do anything to your son. It's me. This is on me. Yahweh, therefore, had a responsibility. He had already, at this point, shared the five benefits of the covenant with Abraham.
Yes.
That Abraham would become immortal, perfected, adopted, enriched, and empowered. Therefore, Yahweh had the responsibility of following through and giving to Abraham what he had promised. It's not a bad thing to come to recognize that God has responsibilities. He has obligations. We don't have any obligations. He does. But he does have requirements, and he should have them. Because if he didn't have requirements for participating in the covenant family, eternity would be far worse than life heroes on earth. Mm-hmm. Far more bad people, far more horrible behavior. Lots more religion, lots more politics, lots more war, because people would be greatly empowered and they would live forever.
Yeah, same old, you know, only worse.
Right, so he has to have requirements. And that word is Mishmeret. My verbalized expressions regarding my mission to provide safeguards and my obligations to fulfilling them. It is from one of the most visual words in Hebrew, mashal.
Mashal, yes.
The mashal is often translated proverb. And proverb is not a bad way to express it. Now, proverb is even based upon the English word verb. Verb is an actionable account. And so the Proverbs are vivid, easily remembered parables regarding wisdom through representation and comparison. Now, the reason that that is important is, have you ever read one of those books on how to transfer something from short-term to long-term memory? How you remember somebody's name if they're introduced to you, or remember a series of numbers? Have you ever read the, how you go about doing that?
No, I've seen the guys that do it. I have not read the book.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Yeah. Well, the technique is always the same. It's to put the person's name or the numbers in an actionable sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's Kirk, they're going to see maybe someone kicking a ball. They're and maybe it's Kirk, so they're going to see a berserk person kicking a ball. And the moment they... they see the actionable thing of your face, you know, kicking a berserk person kicking the ball, they will never forget your name. But if you play the bill, look at your face and remember your name, because they've put that bit of information in an actionable context. And so a mashal is an actionable, vivid portrayal that is easily remembered. It's easily remembered because it's actionable.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that mashal is also based upon the Hebrew verb shamar, to observe.
Yes.
So the next thing is my directions and conditions of the contract, mitzvah. My binding instructions regarding my contractual agreement and my authorized directions regarding the codicils of the relationship.
Let me ask you a question on this.
Sure.
How could you ever, if that's the meaning, and it is. Everywhere you go, that's the meaning. Nobody argues that that's the meaning. How can it be anything? How can it change? I mean, how can you ever wrap around another religion and say this is fulfilling that or this is changing to that? That alone is just blows Christianity, or Paul in particularly out of the water. I mean, forever is forever, and this is what he did, and this is my contract, and he cannot change it.
Yes. But so, this term mitzvah,
how do you rationalize anything else?
Is essentially the synthesis of the Torah and the Bereth covenant. If you take Torah, teaching and instruction, and Bereth family relationship, and you blended them together, then you would have mitzvah defined. Authorized and authoritative instructions and directions regarding the terms and conditions of the relationship. It's God's prescriptions that provide an inheritance and thus an allocation of benefits. So it's really important to take the time and realize that mitzvah is not commandments. There's anything related to a commandment with that word. And the next thing is a tshuva. Remember how often Dode in his 119th Psalm talked about the mitzvah and the tshuva?
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again. And the tshuva are inscribed and clearly communicated prescriptions for living. Tshuva is a... at its core, speaks of being engraved. It addresses the idea of chiseling and instruction in stone.
Mm-hmm. Pretty prominent.
Yeah, I'm familiar with some instructions that have been chiseled in stone. So it's my described and clearly communicated prescriptions for living that are engraved, they are chiseled, they're unchanging, they communicate how we should respond, because again, it needs to be cut into the relationship. It's from choke, to carve out or something and cut someone into a relationship by inscribing a portrayal of the nourishing thoughts behind it. And it, the word is akin to chukar, which means addressing that which can be discovered, explored, probed, and examined to gain information through a determined and comprehensive search. To provide comprehension and understanding.
You know, if you were to look up Shukwa, and I'll just give you the strong number because it shows how close it is, 2708, and then you go to 2710, you have Shukwa. Of course, it means to cut, inscribed, engraved, and write. And then if you look it up as the letters themselves, it means an appointed time, a function, even a duty. But appointed times, and when we're talking about the Moed Mikros. So every connection you make, everywhere you look, it gives you another little nuance of something that he's talking about that's related. Yeah.
And, of course, the last word in this, Kurt, directs our attention to where these things are found.
Yes.
And my Torah. T-O-W-R-A-H. And my Torah. And my source from which my teaching, guidance, instruction, and direction fall. So, that's where all of this can be observed. This is where it can be recited so as to listen to Yah's voice. Now, Kirk, I didn't see any mention of any concept related to faith in that depiction. Did you?
No.
He did not infer.
I'm not.
The benefits of the covenant.
No.
The benefits of the covenant are not going to be availed because Abraham believed it. Now, since that is the crux, that is the fulcrum upon which Galatians is based. That is the fulcrum upon which Pauline Christianity is pivots, where Paul said that because Abraham did not have the Torah, it was by faith that he was made righteous. And this is exactly the opposite, that it was because Yahweh gave him the Torah and he observed it that he received the benefits of the covenant.
Yeah.
So this
we
is
have
the
a deal. It's a written deal. It's a contract.
Right. So,
I mean, David had a right to say, I'm coming to heaven, and you really can't keep me out. This is our deal.
Cool. That's right. So when it comes to participating in the covenant, Yahweh means to engage in a relationship that the antithesis of cult. So, just for a moment, if you were to consider their relative status, God, Paul, and the credulity of their testimony,
mm-hmm.
who do you suppose is right?
Yahweh's right.
Right. Which means Paul is...
He's absolutely wrong.
That means that 2.4 billion Christians have been hoodwinked. They've been misled.
Terribly so.
The tragic thing. And of course, the English translations all serve to miscommunicate this important message, because as we talked about, Shema was written in such a way that in their miscitations, it means to obey. No, Hebrew doesn't have a word for obey, and Shema is the antithesis of obey. It just means to listen. I just listen to you say yes. I can't obey that.
No.
No, it just means to listen.
Not a command. You can't have a command, and you can't ask somebody to obey and have free will. You can't be a lord.
Nope.
I mean, the whole thing becomes ludicrous at a certain point. If you get it, you know, once you go through and you figure out the Shamar, what Shamar means, what Shama means, and what Torah is teaching, as opposed to law. That's the other one they throw at you all the time. And Yahweh has nothing to do with being a lord. That's Baal. You got a word for Lord in Hebrew, and it's always Satan's title, the adversary's title, HaSatan.
Mm-hmm.
Then the whole thing should fall apart in front of your face. But traditions are hard, man.
Versus being completely and totally consistent, brilliant, and this idea that you approach based upon the thing that differentiates humanity from the rest of life. Having not only the soul, which is the consciousness, the ability to observe and respond, but the nefesh, the nesama, in this case, the ability to process information and a brain where that information can be processed in such a way that you can go from knowing that it's happening out there to actually understanding. Like conscience versus just consciousness. So the very thing that separates us from the rest of the animal world is how we approach God. We were designed for this very thing.
Yes. We have an
response. So that takes us to an exchange to, I think, help us know how the Torah is defined. And since now we know that Abraham's basis for being in the covenant was based upon his observation of the Torah,
mm-hmm.
we're going to turn to Shemot names Exodus 4:10.
Okay.
Then Moshe, the one who draws out, said, shared, conveyed to Yahweh, please. He says, I'm not a man of words.
Very, very Lord-like.
Yeah, I'm not a man of words.
Please.
Right. Neither yesterday, nor the day before, nor from the time you spoke to me, your servant. Indeed, my mouth is harsh and unresponsive, and my tongue is thick and slow to move. So, why did Moshe say that?
Because he was tongue-tied. He had poor speech. He had a lisp, I don't know, but he certainly was having trouble speaking and being eloquent.
Yeah, it's
pardon.
Moshe said, "Wait a minute, I heard what you said. You want me to go back into Egypt where I killed a man? It was justifiable. What I did was righteous indignation. But the guy was mercilessly beating up on a person who couldn't defend themselves, and I stopped it. And I did something that was righteous. You know, there are times when hate are the right thing to do, and he did that, but." Of course, the authorities in Egypt aren't going to see that as an appropriate response, so he can't go back there without the death penalty being imposed. So he said, wait a minute, that's not a good thing. And he had left it. The last thing you want to do is go back.
Yeah. At this stage, why would he want to go back?
Well, he didn't want to go back.
No.
And while he was there, the one thing he did not know is, he did not know God.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And so he's saying God. Now, I was, you can see it going through his mind. I was brought up in Pharaoh's household. You know, I know the politics of Egypt, and I hated it. I know the religion of Egypt. I hated it. I served in the army of Egypt. I hated it. I saw the economics of Egypt based upon slavery and the abuse of people, and I hated it. Those are the things that I know, and I hate all of them. That's what I left. That's what I walked away from. But I don't know you. Now, I'm not qualified to do this. And most importantly, you just asked me to speak for you. And, you know, at this point, my vocabulary is harsh. I don't have any kind words to say to the Egyptians. I'm not going to sweet-talk them into this. My discussions, my thoughts regarding them are harsh. My words describing my position with them is harsh. I really have difficulty speaking. Yeah, my tongue is thick and slow to move. I'm not the slick talker that you deserve. And I'm around. You've got those preachers, man. You hear those guys, and they're so eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
How am I
going
to be?
Don't you think he's having his close-hand knowledge of the priesthood in Egypt, that he would have seen them as the phonies that they are? And that's distasteful, too. I mean, why, you know, probably all of these things ran through his mind. You know, I don't want to be one of those.
Right.
I don't even really know who you are. You know, I know I'm in the presence of something. It's obvious once you read it and translate it. He knows he's in the presence of a power. So it's not that, but he doesn't know anything really about him, per se. And he's going, go back there and represent something. No. I can see a lot of reasons why he would act the way he did.
Yeah.
I don't think it was fear. He wasn't a cowardly kind of man.
No, he wasn't a cowardly man. But he viewed himself as unqualified. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he was qualified. But beyond that, and that is that, you know, I have felt, and I'm sure you do as well, that having grown up in politics, having grown up in religion, having embraced those two things, having advocated those things, having advocated patriotism and militarism, I'm in a much better position to expose and condemn them in consistency with Yahweh's testimony, because I understand the beast.
Yeah,
I think
Yahweh
wanted that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yahweh, this, you know what's wrong. That's why you walked away from it. Therefore, you're already properly prepared to go out and speak against it. You can, I don't have to teach you everything. I can teach you about me because you already know about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I wanted to do is teach Moshe about them. He wanted to teach Moshe about him. So by taking a guy that had been exposed to all the evil of the economic and military and political and religious system of Egypt, he didn't have to focus any attention on what's wrong with them. Moshe already knew it. He focused his heart on the
solution,
right? So it's a combination of many things. One is he was properly prepared to understand what was wrong about all aspects of Egyptian life. And he knew he wasn't qualified, which made him wholly dependent. And then best of all, he's the person that John was going to convey his testimony and his name. And God picked a person that stutters. Who had a speech impediment.
I appreciate the humor in that.
You've got to appreciate the humor in that. Yeah, the moment that you think privileged or special because Yahweh is using you in some way, look at the people that he used. You know, to convey how to observe the Torah, he picked a guy that had more flaws and more deviant behaviors than he had hairs on his head. So, to convey his name and his message so that we could recite it and listen to him, observe it, he picked a guy that had a speech impediment. to convey the terms and conditions of the covenant, he picked a guy that was not the sharpest tool in the shed, Abraham. Abraham didn't get it for a long time. It took a lot for Abraham to understand. Finally did. He passed the open book test.
Yeah. He chose a land lover.
I was questioning, so why would Moshe say that, please, Yahweh, I am not a man of words, neither yesterday, nor the day before, nor from the time you spoke to me. So he's not just saying, I'm not a man of words. I wasn't a man of words yesterday. I wasn't a man of words before you spoke to me. I'm still not a man of words.
No.
So it's kind of like he's saying, all right, you're the creator of the daggone universe, but you would think that you could fix it so I could speak better with you. Yeah, you give me a little miracle here. And then I'll go. Show me a little miracle here.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little goose here, a little prop. So I'm feeling a little better about it. Oh, yeah, it works. You get to know him. You get to trust him. You know he's beside you and working with you and leading you and guiding you when you just listen to what he has to say. When you process his testimony. When you engage and rely on it. And that's what Yael was saying. Hey, man, do this and you will come to know. All the confidence that you need will be there.
Yeah.
We'll work together on this. And if I don't make it such that you can really be eloquent, then you're going to constantly rely on me. And that's a good thing. You're never going to go out on a limb on your own. So, and it's also important here to recognize that in terms of revelation, Moshe is the most important person in human history. When it comes to insights, Dode is the most important person in history. When it comes to the access to the information you need process to lead to understanding, Moshe is the single most important person in human history.
Yeah.
And he was not a dynamic political leader. He was not a valiant military officer. He was not a charismatic preacher. He was not someone who could speak in tongues. He was not a scholar. He was not a bastion of virtue. Moshe was a broken-down, 80-year-old sheep herder on the lam for having killed an Egyptian taskmaster who was now roaming the western desert of Arabia. That's what he picked. Now, that tells you how many people, if they're serving God in politics or in religion or in academia, but they're somehow special and qualified. No, not from God's perspective. Who did he pick?
Good old Moshe.
A guy that was the antithesis of all those things. Therefore, Yahweh said to him, who made the mouth of the man Adam? Or who could have made him mute? Or if he had so desired death, or sighted, or blind, if not me, Yahweh. That's pretty humbling, right?
That's pretty humbling.
You have to discuss with God, you say, okay, you don't want me, and I don't want to do this because I have a speech impediment.
Mm-hmm.
God comes and says, wait a minute. Come on. I'm really not into blowing smoke. I'm not into trying to impress you, but let's have a quick little understanding here, so you have some perspective on this, Moshe. So, from a perspective point of view, who made Adam's mouth?
Yahweh did.
Could I have made him mute if I wanted to? Yeah. Could I have made him mute if I wanted to?
Sure.
Could I have made him deaf if I wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
Could I have made him sighted or blind? Why do you think that I made him sighted? Why do you think I made him audible? Why do you think I made it so that he could hear? Why do you think I did those things?
Yeah, but those things so he could see, so he could shamar, so he could shama.
Right. Yeah, I did all that stuff. So you think I can handle the fact that you've got a speech impediment?
Mm-hmm. You know, I dug up some stuff in here, just an idea. But as I was looking at the words that he chose for speaking and for hearing and for seeing.
Yes.
And the question I was asking as I was doing it, I don't read your commentary. I try not to read anything before I break down all the words, and I try to figure out what it's saying here, and then I'll read your take on it. That way, I try to avoid being influenced too much on whatever direction,
yeah.
And then I go back and read yours, which is I find easier or more rewarding, I should say, because I have to dig a little harder. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about Yahweh. Moshe didn't have a problem with his seeing, and he didn't have a problem with his hearing. The whole issue was his speech, and yet Yahweh brings up all three of them, and I was wondering, is that significant at all, or did it mean anything beyond just the obvious that you stated there? And I think that's all true, but also when I looked at speak, which is a lem, and then hear, which he uses the word cheresh, and then to see, he uses pekwash. So I looked those up, and then I looked up the roots to some of those things, as well as some of the verbal roots to them. And
uh-huh.
It's really kind of interesting that he's done, if you look him up, he's almost like he's a little side show going on where he's describing the situation of his family or mankind.
I came up with that conclusion.
Did you? Well, I came up with it because, first of all, he uses Elam, which means to be unable to speak, but it also means to bind. And it means to bound up the tongue. So I asked myself, well, Yah obviously is not looking for a great speaker, but one that will not be silenced, nor will he be bound by a religion of political words and power. So that's just to me, it's a little underlying thing, because you don't really look it up and say, okay, that means to be bound of tongue. You just say it's unable to speak. That's the way, or mute. But alone,
right.
Is a lot of, you know, there are other words for speak that he didn't have to use elim or elam.
Yes.
Then you go to then the next one was shiresh,
yeah,
which
Mar,
is death.
Yeah, Mar, the typical word for speak, amar,
yeah.
Devar.
Oh yeah, I've got several. We've got for speak. You can have amar. You could have pay, or you could say I can't speak. Lo amar. You could say it a lot of different ways. He
right.
could have said it. So I'm always curious when he uses a word that is a little less obvious, because he used the mar earlier in the first part of the sentence. So why didn't
right.
he use the mar again? So maybe there's something
yeah.
there or not. Then sheref is to be deaf, and sheresh from sheresh, which is the verb to be silent, and extreme silence, and unable or unwilling to listen. And then there was pekwesh, which is seeing or sight. Now, there are other words for seeing and sight. You could say
yeah.
ra, smar. To carefully right. consider, provoking, that sort of thing. And then, but...
So many words for sight. Why? And all of the time we've done this, you know, you might see God one out of 100 times based on the other words.
Very infrequent. So
right.
I looked at the verbal root on that one. Now, you have the quack, which is open your eyes and ears.
Right.
Alluding to the senses. If you look at the letters, you have a double Q and a check, which is to be perceptive, to understand. And even the words wrapped around it let me show you. Let's go a little further on that one.
Okay.
There's a word that follows it. He says, pakwa, and then he says, or. And that doesn't seem like much, but it says, but I looked up or, I'm probably mispronouncing it, I'm fumbling on my words, I have a thick tongue too, which is A-W-H-R, which means unable to receive light, to be blinded, from I-wear, which is darkness of the eye, to put out the light. It means to cover something that covers, like a skin, a hide, a leather, or chaff. We know the relationship to chaff and the wheat from the chaff. It's like something I'm going to be suffering from here a little bit, starting now with cataracts or a film or a skin over your eyes. And then there's a related word to that, A-Y-I-R, which is a male donkey. And I said, no, what's that got to do with anything? And but if you think about Islam, one of the things that they never do is listen or hear or see.
Right.
And then I looked up, you know, and then I looked up the word on that one, which is an ain and a double yod or double yod, and a rosh. I mean, rosh.
Yeah.
And it's the and it means the wrong perspective. And it also means a dark force, a dark or a wicked place.
The wrong perspective. Okay.
Yeah, so I'm looking at, now everybody won't do what I do or have as much fun doing what I do, but I'll just look through these things, and I don't make up the connections. I'm using search engines, and I'm using roots like the, if it's a noun, you know, you'll have a verbal root, and then every program, any decent program will say, okay, this is related to this word, related to this word, related to this word, so I'll just follow the source and see if it has any legs. And throughout this entire passage, there's almost like an underlying metaphor for our condition. We don't see, we don't hear, and we don't, you know, we just don't listen, we don't see, we don't observe, and we speak poorly or incorrectly. Now, that may be too much to grab out of that, but all the little connecting words really help if you go to the secondary meanings of each one of the words or the tertiary meanings of those things. So,
yeah, one of the things that occurred to me is just to look at it face value. Peacock, to be sighted, is to be capable of being perceptive and being open-minded. You require both if you're going to know Yao, right?
Exactly.
Receptive,
exactly.
Open-minded. And blind is incapable of being observant. Therefore, closed-minded. That's the contrast. Who made man open-minded or capable of being closed-minded?
I am open-minded.
Exactly.
We do that too. Yeah.
And you know what's interesting too is that Yahweh here is not taking any chances that we would miss the fact that he has a name.
Mm-hmm.
I did this. Me,
Yahweh.
Yahweh. So now, this being the case, you know, at this point, if I'm Moshe, I'm putty on the floor, right?
Yeah.
because this isn't something small. This isn't, you know, like long ago, yeah, said, hey, you know, I want you to expose and condemn Islam for me. And I said no, and I don't have any interest in that, and I'm not qualified. And you need to find somebody else. And you know, I said, all right, well, you know, maybe we could negotiate this. And you know, I came up with my terms and conditions. Okay. On a 1 to 10 scale of importance, that's say 0.00000001. Now we're talking about freeing the children of Israel from politics, from religion, from economic schemes, from militarism, all the ways of man, and taking them to the promised land. And in the process, revealing God's instruction. All right, so there isn't a more important job,
no.
A more important mission. And so, you know, God is making it. This is a lot more than any of us have ever experienced. He's just saying, hey, Moshe, come on, get a grip here. Come to understand what's happening here, who I am, before you worry about something as silly as stuttering.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, so now, this being the case, therefore, straight away and henceforth, then as a rational and a direct consequence, it is only logical that you should decide to go. You should walk with your own free will. Call imperative. And I myself will be alongside your mouth, and I will guide and teach Yark you what you should say regarding the way to the benefits of the relationship, Asher Tabar. So, Moshe, recognizing that, you know, I've got this under control. I made the mouth, I made the ears, I made the brain. I know what I'm doing. I'm a pretty darn good creator. I, I'm, I got this. So this being the case, recognizing who I am and what I have done, really, you should decide to go. It's the right choice. Choose of your own free will, but you really ought to decide to go.
Yeah.
And I myself will be with your help. Don't worry about it. I'm right there. I got this. Moreover, I'm going to Yarak. Yarak is the verb that is the basis of the Torah. According to Yahweh, when Yahweh introduces this Torah, he introduces it based upon the verb Yarak, which means to guide and to teach.
Mm-hmm.
I will formally lay the foundation and establish with you the source from which direction and instruction flow, pouring out knowledge to you as a teacher to make the truth known, to quench the thirst of humanity, to totally refresh the human spirit and mind. What you should say, Asher the Bar, mm-hmm. regarding the way to the benefits of the relationship.
Yeah. And it's always, you know, it's not the Paul stuff, the Christian stuff. He's always, everything is back to these fundamental things about how you benefit, what are the benefits of a relationship and how you can observe them and make them yours.
Correct. So, he taught Moshe so Moshe could teach us.
Mm-hmm.
All about teaching and guidance, right?
Yes.
All about Asher. Yeah. The way to the benefits of the relationship. So, this
now
is
we have
an extraordinary important statement. I myself is going to be with you. You know, when I did those 5,000 radio shows as a guest, where I never prepared for one of them, ever.
Yes.
And I was never stumped with a question I couldn't answer. The deal was that that's a difference. It's a job I want done. So I'm going to handle it. You know, he doesn't intervene very often in human affairs, but if it's his business, something he wants done,
mm-hmm.
he'll take care of business. That's what he told Moshe. I'll take care of business there. That's something I want done. So I had a little inkling of that in the 5,000 interviews that I did.
Mm-hmm.
That's not near the level of Moshe here, but you know, that's it. I'm going to teach you, and I'm going to guide you so that you can teach others. It's an important thing that we're going to go do together.
Mm-hmm. You know what proves that Moshe didn't know, I was just thinking this just now, you know what proves that Moshe didn't know Yahweh in the plan? Yahweh has to do this because he's promised Abraham they got 400 years and then he's going to take them out. It's a done deal if Yahweh says so. It would have been a done deal to all of his family, early family. And Moshe had no clue. Otherwise, he would have said, oh, this must be the 400 years must be up. Let's go. You know, there would never been this conversation. So he just didn't know him, did he?
No. But what Yahweh did with Moshe is the same thing he did with Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to recognize their position when Yahweh spoke to them.
Oh, yeah. That they walked away, you mean?
Yeah, both cases. Did Abraham know Yahweh when Yahweh introduced himself?
No, not at all. No, not at all.
Okay. Did Moshe know Yahweh when Yahweh introduced himself to
him? No.
No. Not a clue. And were either man engaged in the politics or the religion of their country?
No, I never would approach them, in my opinion.
Yeah, they were as far away from that as they could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham was as far away from Ur of the Chaldeans, Babylon, as a man could be at that time, really.
Mm-hmm.
He followed the Tigris and Euphrates River all the way to Haran. You know, at that point, he would have to leave the rivers to go south into Israel. But, man, that was... He was close to the headwaters.
Yeah.
To the source, not the mountain. And with Moshe, he was in the Netherlands, man. You can't get much further away from Egyptian civilization than the barren desert of Arabia. That's where he was. So these men had deliberately chosen to walk away from human, religious, and political institutions. That's where they were. And neither man knew God when God introduced himself. Now, that tells us a great deal. That means that we're in the same position, that God chooses who he introduces himself to. Both men now had the opportunity to reject Yahweh and say, I'm not going there. Thanks, but find somebody else.
Well,
both men had pretty different. All God did was provide an introduction. From that point on, it was up to the free will of each individual to follow up on what he said. And that is essential to our understanding of how we all engage in a relationship with him. We aren't going to find
it. You know, we were talking about this the other day. I think when Mary came over, either time before last, perhaps, or something on the Shabbat. And we were talking about that. I don't know of too many people. I can't think of anyone who was not in the same situation and hadn't already walked away to whatever degree we could walk away, you know, but had disengaged with the church or disengaged with politics. And then they either read your book or somebody talks to them about that or something of that nature, or they start questioning, and some have independently found it and then found you after that. But they all had disengaged from their religion and politics prior to the getting close to Yahweh.
Yeah, as had I. I mean, I was a evangelical Christian and very political in the Republican Party. And I had come to see a plague on both of their houses and had left them, became an agnostic and apolitical. You know, and so it was only then that Yahweh introduced himself, and I had no idea who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Got to know him. So I listened to what he had to say. I got to trust him because I engaged based upon what he wanted done. It's what happens with each of us. So I don't think that any of us come to him on our own merit. Mm-hmm. I mean, God provides an introduction, and then it's up to us to follow up on it or reject it. I don't think he offers that invitation to very many people, because I don't think he's even willing to do it unless you're already like Abraham out of Babylon or like Moshe out of Egypt. And then he'll do it. And that's the only time that he'll do it. And why? Is because he wanted to teach and guide him to the benefits of the relationship. It's a choice that we can make. He gives us the choice, the opportunity, an invitation. We can make the choice as to whether or not we're going to act upon what he is offering, if we're going to engage. And it's really only by engaging that you develop that sense of confidence and knowledge and appreciation and all that sort of thing. So, very insightful if you read between the lines, think about all that is being conveyed here. Now, in this section, Kirk, one of the things that I wanted to do was to talk about the fact that this man, Moshe, became the implement to reveal Yahweh's Torah teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just think about what the Torah is based on. And I spent days and days looking up everything that's remotely akin to Torah. And so what I found is that it's the toe or tor, the tour, the Torah, the tube, the tobe prefixes to yara that turn this verb into a title. And if you look at that's toe. It speaks of a signature. Well, this is the Torah is God's signature. Toe means a signature that's part of a written document that leaves an endearing mark of authorship. Well, so the first three letters in Torah are TWR, mean this is my signature on a written document that provides an endearing mark regarding its authorship. Well, that's a pretty credible start, don't you think?
That's a very good start, yeah.
The end of it is Yara, which is a source of instruction and teaching, this place which direction and guidance flow. So, it's written insights regarding guidance that leave an enduring mark on our world, on our lives, on our soul. Ko is also an expression of a desire to exempt someone from judgment. It's a pretty good indication of what Torah means, which is that's the Torah's purpose. Along these lines, Kub speaks of providing answers which facilitate our restoration and our return, enabling us to respond properly. Now, recognizing that the Hebrew characters Teth and Tah were derived from the same letter, we discover that Tov is something which is good, pleasing, joyful, beneficial, pleasant, favorable, healing, and right. The Torah is not a bunch of restrictive laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's empowering and enlightening instruction, directions, guidance. And even better, to be Tov is to be loved, to become acceptable and to endure.
Yes.
Yahweh affirms this connection by telling us that his Torah is Tov.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is possible because both Or and Torah speak of that which is purifying and cleansing.
Purifying cleanliness, yeah. Free of
Now, especially revealing is that Tor summarizes the essence of Yahweh, providing the means to explore, to seek, to find, and to choose. Tor thereby defines the operative aspect of Shamar, diligently observing, closely examining, carefully considering, so as to properly respect what is being said and respond. Now, spelled the same way in the text, Tor provides the opportunity to change, to turn around,
mm-hmm.
and to head in a different direction, a more fortuitous, beneficial direction. A Tor is also a dove, which is the metaphor for Yahweh's set apart spirit.
That's right.
Torah speaks of that which is amazing, wondrous, and extraordinary.
Astonishing, yes.
Yeah. The Torah is used to designate someone's mark or sign. It is presented as a written document. We find that Todah means to celebrate, to be thankful as part of a relationship or fellowship. And that Tobah is to celebrate and be is becoming correct. And Tub is that which is desirable, manifesting that which is beneficial and right. Another variation of Tur, this one would speak of arranging stepping stones from a straight path so as to properly position them as to establish a firm foundation and an unwavering way. And as Tur, it signifies the mountain which represents Yah's power, authority, and kingdom. So that's a lot to pack into four letters, wouldn't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Two consonants, two vowels, which comprise Torah. What's really interesting is that Torah tells you how to pronounce Yahweh's name. That's part of the instruction in Torah. The Wah and the Hey. The only letter that's in Yahweh's name that isn't a Wah and a Hey is one that no one disputes. The Yod. So it's just the word itself and the fact that it's probably the second most conveyed Hebrew word of all time. Shalom would be the most, and Torah would be the second most.
Yes.
Tells you how to pronounce the name that these Nimrods would say is unpronounceable. So the very basis of the title teaches you how to pronounce the name. So if we bring all these insights together, when we observe the Torah from the perspective provided by the Hebrew lexicon, we discover that we are witnessing Yahweh's Toh, signed, written, and enduring, Torah, way of treating people, Tur, giving us the means to explore, to seek, to find, and to choose Yara, the source from which instruction, teaching, guidance, and direction flow, which Tub provides answers which facilitate our restoration and return, even our response and reply to that which is Tov.
Mm-hmm.
Good, pleasing, joyful, beneficial, and favorable. Healing and right. And that which causes us to be loved, to become acceptable, and to endure. Tahorah, purifying and cleansing us, Tor, so as to provide an opportunity for us to change our thinking, attitude, and direction. four letters. A person reaching up to Yahweh, the last letter. A person with perspective, their eyes, their mind, their ears, their mind, everything integrated.
Engaged.
Yes. Yeah, to be made more secure, to be enlarged, to be enriched. And of course, this symbol, which became the T, really, in the English alphabet. It's the horizontal support beam and the vertical pillar, which speaks of the doorway, the means to support the tent, the home of its day, and therefore the tabernacle where Yahweh met with his children. It comprised the elements of the doorway, and therefore symbolic for Passover, the doorway to live.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the character, Tah, actually a rabbinic corruption of its original designation, Toh, which conveys the actual meaning, especially its most revealing term, Torah, signature, sign, mark of authority. And back in the day, the signature was not an X. No, it was this Toh, this Toh. And the X, you know, is two diagonals? No, the symbol for signature and sign was a vertical pillar and a cross member, a horizontal member.
You know, I had done this years ago, and
yesterday
I did it again, and I did it even with all the letters, probably seven different lexicons involved with this, and everything you've written, you can't find anything that argues with that. I found a couple of cuties. I mean, when you said two, you know, which means to return or answer, give a reply, or restore. From shub, which is to turn back, return to God. Build, it even means circumcision, which is, you know, something you have to do as one of the terms and conditions to become part of the family. I don't care where you look. I mean, this is what you did is brilliant. I mean, it's, I'm not just patting you on the back. I'm just telling you, it's really good. And if you want the challenge to go find it, and find something, if you think this is not what Torah means, then you can't find it. So if you think this is law, then I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, it's all there for us.
It's all there, yeah. And it's always teaching. It's always the big word teaching. It's always instruction, guidance, direction.
Yeah.
Everything.
There is absolutely no inference of any kind, any of the roots, or any of the bases, or any of the letters, or any of the context of Torah, which would imply law.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. No. This corruption of the law is nonsensical. It's just unbelievably stupid. You know, when I was logging on to today's program, the first thing I saw, and I normally don't see it because most of my computers go directly to the login page where I bring up the studio, but you know, I was traveling, so I'm on a different laptop, and the first thing that came up was kind of a page of commentary of people that listen to the program, and there's one guy that just says, you know, you guys are all completely lost because, you know, it's clear that the only place that you can observe any of this stuff is in Jerusalem. And God says it's got to be in Jerusalem that you're doing.
Well, I'm not sure he wasn't.
No.
He never made it to Israel.
They weren't in Jerusalem the next 40 years, and they celebrated, didn't they?
Yeah.
And that's Torah absurd. Doesn't mean that you do it as I and obey what I have said. What Torah means is that's instruction.
Yeah.
Teaching. Guidance.
Yeah.
Think it through. Why are these things associated? Why is Sukkah associated with Jerusalem? Mm-hmm. Well, because Jerusalem is the source from which, the same verb, the source for instruction, guidance, and direction regarding reconciliation flow.
Flows, yes.
Yeah, think it through. It's as JB said in the last program, it's not about someone wondering, what do I do to be accepted? It's what you need to understand so that you can respond
correctly
and accept what Yahweh has said.
Well, here's the definition of Torah. Is besides everything you've done, in addition to, it's an acquired knowledge or skill that marks the direction that one is to take in life, like the Moed Mikra, a straight, upright direction. It's a knowledge passed from one person to another, which is what Moshe was all about. Because Yah was always using human beings to help human beings. He doesn't interfere as much as everyone seems to think. Otherwise, he's a story of free will. So, if I'm lost, then I'll stay in this forest.
Everybody Scott is in the chat room. I just realized he made a comment here that is really good. He's saying that he sees someone in quicksand. Yeah, I was not going to wade into the same quicksand. It would be counterproductive if we saw somebody in quicksand to wade into the quicksand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both of us are in time, right? So what Yahweh does, he throws you a line. He reaches out, he extends his hand and arm.
And
now, if the person is just going to flail because they want to do it on their own, they're going to die. The more you flail, the faster you sink. But if you accept that outstretched arm and grab hold of it, and then relax and allow the person to pull you out, to lift you up, just let go. Trust. Then you're out of the quicksand for two reasons. One is the person that's reaching out to you isn't in the quicksand. They're on solid footing. And you're relaxing, which means you're no longer sinking, and you're trusting them to pull you out. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how this is. Yeah. So God's not going to jump into the crucible of religion and politics to corrupt himself along with you. He will reach out and pull you out of it so long as you're willing to relax and let him do so, to trust him to do so. So, very rich, very deep, very meaningful concepts. And God has put Moshe on notice that, I got this. Trust and rely on me, and you're going to be just fine. You're going to learn everything you need to know about this relationship. And that's going to put you in a position where you think, I can teach you, provide the instructions regarding, put in your mouth, regarding the means to this beneficial relationship. And Kirk Rubin, then going on to the next, sometimes I think we're just better off allowing ourselves to linger on concepts that are this important. We haven't really talked about the basis for and the meaning and the ingredients of Torah in a long time. But that's specifically what Yahweh was offering through Moshe to us. And he was offering it in a really important context. Reaching out to a man who had been there and had left in such a situation as his entire mission was to go get these people from the slavery and the burden of being in a religious and political and economically corrupt environment, pulling them out and leading them away from the quicksand that is in Egypt. Quicksand that is of human, political, and religious constructs, and taking them away and liberating them, cleansing them, adopting them, empowering and enriching them in the process so that they could live with them in the promised land. That was the purpose. It was taking them away from religion and liberating them. It wasn't causing them to be, to obey or to somehow enslave them. Paul's whole mantra of Christianity was that the God of the Old Testament, man, he's enslaving because it's of the flesh. No, it's exactly the opposite. God chose this man to lead his children away from religion and politics and towards the promised land, which was like Eden, where there is no religion and politics, just a relationship with God. And he provided all the teaching we need to know to get there and enjoy it.
You realize that these Israelites were the only free peoples in the entire world. And they followed Yahweh. So what should that tell you?
Yeah.
Name another free people. There aren't any.
Yeah, every other human civilization was a dictatorship, where there was no freedom of religion or thought.
They all had a king.
No freedom.
They didn't have a king. They had a father. They had a shepherd.
People doing anything.
Yeah.
An entirely different situation than anybody else. So, yeah, and that's exactly right. They were the freest people in the world. They were the most intellectually advanced people in the world. They were the most literate people in the world.
You know, when you were talking a little earlier about... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Taken to an extraordinary place. It couldn't have been a better situation. And led there by a man that didn't want any power. Led there by a man that didn't want anything other than the opportunity for them to know the means of this relationship. It's marvelous.
Yeah.
But
there was one other question that was answered by this when we started, when you were talking about Abraham writing it down on whatever implements he would have had, whether it was a sheepskin or whether it was some kind of papyrus or something at that time. And in the conditions he lived in, he obviously couldn't write long scrolls of information, but he certainly had everything he needed. But what that proves also is this is a group of people that are always literate. They're always educated. They can read, write, and count, obviously. I was making the point to someone the other day that, you know, when Joseph shows up in Egypt, even though he's 11 years in prison, but when they let him out, he virtually runs the place. This is not an illiterate slave. This is not someone who can't count and organize and do all that sort of thing. So, and what prompted the conversation is these people, Israel, or have always historically been extremely well-educated, and that's why people don't like them much, because half of the world is, if you think about most of the world being enslaved and illiterate,
yes.
Because you don't make the slaves literate. That's why in the South, and during the Civil War, prior to the Civil War, it was against a crime to educate a slave, because then they would have power. They might be able to figure things out.
Every country in the Middle East, every country in Northern Africa, mm-hmm. above them, below them, west of them, and east of them, is there a single country where there's actual democracy, where there's actual representative
not even close.
People?
Not even close.
Yeah, not even close. It's the only one. There's like 60 countries surrounding them. There's only one. Yeah, if you look at humanity, these people represent about... 0.2% of humanity,
mm-hmm.
and yet, in terms of human invention, human enlightenment, they represent some 40% of human development and enlightenment, in terms of what they have discovered.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah, they are the most brilliant people on earth. Well, that should tell you about what God values. His family is smart.
And they're not, you know, they're not like we have been most of our life, not now so much, but so much of our life in our history in our country, and that the women were not allowed to go to school. Same thing the Muslims do now. They don't let them go to school. If they do, they do it at their own risk. You know, so half of the population there doesn't get a chance to get an education. But
is there a single derogatory statement of restricting women in the Torah?
No.
But in Christianity,
it's pretty hot stuff, man.
Yeah, if women are treated terribly, they have no rights. In the Arab world, women have equal rights.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you a lot there, too.
It should.
And so the entire communication is to a brilliant people with brilliant insights. Well, Kirk, I'd like to end it there. We'll pick it up at this point next week.
All right.
Just take
I enjoy it. Thank you.
What we have been taught and why Torah is such a rich word, speaking of instructions and teaching and guidance. and and the people that it was communicated to.
Mm-hmm. No. Brilliant piece of work, truly.
Yeah, truly. It is the Torah is a brilliant, most enlightening document in the world, most empowering document in the world. But empowering, liberating, enriching. The very testimony of the creator of the universe himself. The man, the individual that made it possible for us to be open-minded. For us to listen, for us to speak, for us to see. He gave us those perceptions so that we could know him. All right, my friends. We bid you good night, and we'll be back with you again in a week. Stay safe from those fires. Good night. May you all bless.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom.